This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll begin today with a detour into the working innards of this economy. We will check in on your mental health, and we will learn some lessons from the zombie apocalypse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 19th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a somewhat fundamental question to be asked here. Well, I mean, there are a lot of fundamental questions we all ought to be asking ourselves right now. But macroeconomically speaking, as the federal government gets set to push out $1 trillion or more into this economy to stave off the worst of the coronavirus, the fundamental question is, that's a whole lot of borrowing, isn't it? And yes, it is, objectively. An ancillary question, though, goes like this. Does debt, even an extra 10-figure debt hit like that one, really matter right now? As Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, maybe not.
Here's the thing about debt, if you are the U.S. government.
You don't actually have to pay off debt.
Paul Krugman is professor of economics at the City University of New York and a Nobel laureate. He's not saying that governments can just steal money and never pay it back. He is saying governments can just keep borrowing.
In an economy like the U.S., all you need to do is make sure that the debt over the long term grows more slowly than the economy, which is actually really easy to do because interest rates are well below growth rates.
If the economy grows faster than the debt, a country can borrow and still be in good shape indefinitely. You can borrow a lot this way.
Britain has had debt of 150% or more of GDP for a large part of its modern history, never had a problem. Japan has 200% of GDP, doesn't have a problem.
U.S. debt is at 100% of GDP. Under normal circumstances, too much government borrowing can crowd out private sector investment. But these are not normal circumstances, Krugman says. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, where she spends a lot of time worrying about debt levels.
Now is not the moment to be worrying about the deficit at all.
But she says that doesn't mean it's okay to be careless.
It certainly is a moment to make sure that the measures that we develop and implement are smart and not stupid. We need to get money into the economy as quickly as possible. We need to make sure that it is targeted towards the people who need it the most and the places where it will be the most productive.
And she says temporary. One day, when things are better, the government can try and rein things in. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today seemed to believe things are better, but you can't really trust the markets lately, can you now? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange is high on the list of icons of American capitalism. The hustle and bustle during a rally, those stock photo shots of traders facepalming during a crash, all of that stuff. Electronic trading, though, as we've told you on this program, has done away with the need for a lot of the face-to-face wheeling and dealing that you used to see happen. So when the NYSE decided this week to temporarily shut down the floor and move to all electronic trading starting on Monday, there was some notion that not much would really change. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, at the New York Stock Exchange, physical trading does still matter.
The roughly 400 traders that mill around on the NYSE trading floor have certain advantages, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel.
They're there hanging out with the other traders. They hear things. They see things. They feel things.
That kind of information is valuable, especially at the end of the trading session. That's when a special auction helps determine the closing prices for stocks. Angel says human traders can react to new information in real time and call up their clients and say,
"Hey, this is what might be happening. What do you want me to do if?"
Floor traders can also step in when technology doesn't work. Back in 2012, a financial firm's trading software accidentally bought and sold hundreds of stocks when markets opened. Justin Schack is the head of market structure at Rosenblatt Securities, a big floor broker on the New York Stock Exchange. Even though his firm wasn't having the problem,
there were folks on the New York Stock Exchange, including some of our people, that were involved with recognizing that and shutting down some of the stocks that had just opened at crazy prices.
Schack says having human traders together in a place where they can see and speak with one another is important during times of stress. And right now, as we're seeing huge market swings day to day,
you know, having human beings on the floor is especially important at a time like that. So it's unfortunate that they're not going to be there come Monday.
The New York Stock Exchange says its markets are fully capable of operating in an all-electronic fashion. Stacey Cunningham is the NYSE president.
Running the New York Stock Exchange fully electronically is something that we've tested with our customers repeatedly.
But she says in the long run, the market will benefit when it can return to a combination of trading technology and human judgment. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This is going to sound like kind of a sweeping way to put this, I guess. But this economy right now, as in today, is completely different than it was even like Monday, forget last week. And just like we are still figuring things out, so too are the markets. Details, of course, later, as we say. But today, after a week of historic losses, the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all closed up. Adina Friedman runs the company that is responsible for that third index that we always talk about. She's the president and CEO of NASDAQ Incorporated. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
First of all, given the way things have been going the last couple of 3 weeks, how's your mood?
Well, it definitely has been a very interesting and anxiety-filled time for the economy and for everyone in the economy. I think here at NASDAQ, we've been very focused on making sure that we maintain the safety and health of our employees. And of course, we also maintain the functioning of the markets. So my mood is very high energy at the moment.
Yeah, I bet. I think everybody's is. To your mind, are the markets that you are responsible for functioning the way they are supposed to? Volatility aside, are the guts of this thing working?
Yes, the plumbing of the markets are working very, very well. And I think it is important to note that we've spent years working on improving the resiliency of the U.S. markets. And I do think that it is showing through today across the whole market system, whether it's our markets, but also other markets that trade equities, options, futures. Of course, people are finding that there are a lot of stresses in the system. There's a lot of volatility in the markets. We've been hitting record days on multiple occasions, maybe 2 to 3 times the amount of volume that we saw just a year ago. But the markets are handling it well, and the plumbing is working well.
Let me ask you a question I am getting all the time, and I know you've got a position on this. Why not, given the uncertainty, the fear? Panic is a very strong word, but there are days where it feels like that. Why not close the markets and let things settle out and then reopen?
I think it's really important to remember what the foundation of the markets are and the purpose they serve in the economy. We have hundreds of companies out there using the markets to fund their businesses, to fund R&D, and to manage through this very challenging time. If you choke off that access to capital, then you really do take down a key pillar of the economy. We also have received some questions about whether or not we should shorten the market hours. Mm-hmm. If you shorten the market hours, we might have even more pent-up demand and challenges in those shortened hours. It also creates other risks to other elements of the system. And we do think it's really paramount to keep the markets open and operating on normal hours.
It takes some guts to go public in this environment, I'll tell you that. But what do you say to the people who are,
for some reason checking their 401ks right now and see the bottom falling out. And they say, look, just turn it all off for a little while.
Well, I think it's important to recognize what is a 401k for, and over what time period do you need to tap that 401k? So I do think that for younger people and people who are still in the middle of their lives and managing through their futures, the 401k is a long-term savings vehicle. Our economy in general is very resilient.
A note here that NASDAQ Incorporated is, in fact, a business. These are not terrible times to be in the stock exchange business, are they?
Well, I would say that in this period of time with elevated volumes, that is a source of revenue for NASDAQ. We also really like it when companies go public and we have a lot of listed companies. So we do want to see a very fast recovery. But we are a resilient business. We have a resilient and differentiated business model, and we are really proud of that.
Adina Friedman is the president and CEO of NASDAQ. Ms. Friedman, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So many listener questions, so little time. We have been doing them all week. Here's another one.
Hi, this is Reuven Lerner from Modi'in, Israel. My question is, what was the economic impact of Spanish flu back in 1918?
So, Reuven, I am a student of history, not an actual historian, so we called up Kathleen Day for this one. She teaches at Johns Hopkins Carey Business School with a specialty in financial crises and contagion.
People were sick. People were afraid to sometimes go out.
So that was 1918, kind of like what we're seeing now, but 100 years ago. So hard economic data wasn't quite like we are used to having today.
There are headlines in one Arkansas newspaper that said estimated businesses were losing $10,000 a day in Little Rock.
Which translates to something along the lines of $190,000 a day today. But what you got to remember here, Reuven, is that there was something else going on back then as well, which was rattling the economy and society alike.
In World War I, to put it in perspective, 100,000 Americans were killed, and the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1920 killed, the estimates are, 675,000 Americans.
The war and the flu eventually ended. The economy boomed in the 1920s until that ended, as we all know, with the crash of 29 and the Great Depression.
So what portion of that came from excess of people trying to make up for what happened in the pandemic or making up for having had to be so frugal during World War I? Hard to say.
Hard to say indeed, as is what's going to happen now. Hard to say as well. Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins there. We thank her for her time. Let us know what you want answered next at marketplace.org or on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Coming up.
I thought, what better example than me to stand on one side of a window and my dad on the other and say, listen, this is who I could infect.
Metaphorical and literal all at the same time. The mind behind and lessons from World War Z. But first, let's do the numbers. So this is a little number we like to call the sad happy music. Seems kind of appropriate, right? The Dow Industrial is up 188 points today, 0.9%, 20,087. The NASDAQ rose 166 points. I should let the music breathe here, huh? It's really good, right? 2.3% there on the NASDAQ, 7,150. The S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.4%, 2,409. Crude oil bounced back today after days of steep declines. Analysts, however, were skeptical the rise would continue given the dim economic prospects globally. Also, the price war between the Saudis and the Russians. Chevron, big oil company, gained 4.2%. ExxonMobil rose 3.9%. ConocoPhillips banked 12% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell just a touch, 1.16%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace. Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We get listener emails all the time. Well, often anyway, telling us how much they enjoy the work that we do. Some not enjoying the work, and that's fine too. But I mention it because we got one this morning that honestly kind of broke me a little bit. Details not terribly important right now. But the point is, we need each other at this moment. Anxiety and uncertainty are off the charts. And that, to be honest, is probably making it harder for you to do your job if you are lucky enough to still be doing it. All of which is to say, access to mental health care is more important now than ever. Starbucks announced earlier this week every worker is going to be able to get 20 free counseling sessions. A lot of employers are offering resources beyond their traditional health care plans as things develop right now. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Heading for the therapist's physical couch is not an option in our new reality of social distancing, so Andrew Facemeyer was glad when his employer, Northern Arizona University, started offering video counseling.
For someone like me who has an anxiety disorder, knowing that I can get a hold of someone is really important because at this time, it's just really easy to get overwhelmed.
At data analytics firm ThoughtSpot, employees like Candace Locke recently got a subscription to the meditation app Calm. She's been working from home in Mountain View, California for the last 2 weeks and is now under a shelter-in-place order. She's been using the app several times a day.
As soon as I start to focus too much on the news, I then bring it up, and just that take a breath is like a good way to reset.
Tom Insel, the former head of the National Institute of Mental Health, says programs employers offer outside of traditional health plans are more convenient.
You know, they can do this through the company's website. And now there are a whole series of different companies and different tools that are available. Everything from peer support and coaching all the way to one-on-one therapy.
Still, he says, so-called employee assistance programs are often limited at smaller companies and those that employ hourly workers. And of the estimated half of private sector workers with access to these resources, less than 7% typically use them. But Raleigh, North Carolina human resource consultant Lori Rudiman says this crisis could be a turning point.
Coronavirus is putting pressure on workers in ways that will really test the well-being not only of the workforce, but the entire society.
And that could mean more employers offering and more employees using mental health services. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Great big chunks of this economy are slowing down. They are stopping, in point of fact, with this pandemic. One that's not, thankfully for all of us, is grocery stores. Yes, things are different. Long and socially distant lines. Less stuff on the shelves for the moment. But still, real consumer demand and need. So we have circled back to some of the people we have been talking to for a year or more now about their buying habits to see what they have noticed as they are stocking up.
Hi, this is Kaya Price-Dennis from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And with the coronavirus starting, my son is back home from college. My daughter is also here. So there are three adults in the house all day, every day, eating three times a day, plus a couple snacks. So we'll see how that goes. One thing I'm very happy about is we buy food in bulk, and I can get chicken breasts at $1.69 a pound, whereas if I go to a grocery store or Sam's Club, it's like $2.29 to $2.99 a pound. So we'll see how shopping holds up.
This is Ernesto from Chicago. So with everything going on, got some pasta, got some canned goods. It was funny looking at some of the shelves. Everything else is gone but gluten-free pasta. So I guess, you know, the idea is that some things will not sell, not even if the apocalypse is upon us.
This is Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio. There weren't many fresh vegetables. There was absolutely no meat, and the refrigerated shelves were totally empty. The frozen food aisles were barren, but at least they did have milk and bread. I managed to buy a few staples, but, you know, most of the store brands and name brands of canned goods were gone, so I wound up having to pay a good bit extra for, like, specialty and organic foods because, really, it was the only option available. But at the end of the day, I was happy to be able to leave with what I got.
This is Ellen Murphy calling from Mission Hills, Kansas. Hanging up in the hen house grocery store that I went to is a sign that says, you know, if you're a laid off worker from a restaurant, please come see the manager. So I went to the manager and talked to her, and they're trying to get people to work overnight so they can stock. And she said they're not having any trouble getting deliveries. You know, if their stuff is still coming in, but they need a lot of people to keep getting it on the shelves.
That was Kaya Price-Dennis in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Ernesto from Chicago, he asked us not to use his last name. Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio. And Ellen Murphy, she is in Mission Hills, Kansas. Speaking of store shelves, as we were just there, tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow. David Brancaccio is going to have an interview with a guy who knows a thing or two about supermarkets. Rodney McMullen runs Kroger, and he is hiring.
As restaurants and other things have closed, you know, that customer is coming to our stores. So the volume has increased. And right now we have over 10,000 openings. Over the last week, we've hired over 2,000 people.
Rodney McMullen, he's the CEO of Kroger, on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow. And coming today in your podcast feed, we are going daily with Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. She is, of course, what you need to know every afternoon to make today make sense. Things right now are not great on a whole lot of levels, but hey, at least it's not the zombie apocalypse, right? But in that apocalypse could lie some lessons. We called up Max Brooks for a chat. He wrote, most notably, World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide to get some perspective on a situation that does feel kind of apocalyptic at the moment. Max, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here, Kai.
You have talked about your books being self-help guides, really, or how-tos. And this seems like an interesting moment for you to be looking out there and saying, oh, yeah, I wrote about this.
Well, you know, I wasn't really trying to predict the future so much as drawing on the past. World War Z was really based on SARS. So I really wasn't trying to be prophetic in any way. I was simply trying to look at how we had handled disasters throughout our history.
You have a side gig too, right? You work at, you consult for the, not the, who is it? The Army, the Pentagon? Who is it?
Several. I'm a senior non-resident fellow at two think tanks, And I've also done work for the, of all things, the Blue Ribbon Biodefense Panel, which is trying to get us ready for, of all things, the next pandemic.
So what are those lectures like? When you stand up there and say, hey, everybody, I'm Max Brooks, how does that go?
It's always the same. I always get a few cocked heads, you know, who is this guy? And then by the end of the lecture, there's always one person who will corner me afterwards and say, listen, I heard what you said and I need you to come talk to my group. And that's pretty much been the same way since World War Z became reading at the Naval War College.
So when these people come to you and say, come talk to my organization, what do you think it is that they want to hear?
You know, I think as an outsider, I have the advantage of the big picture. And so I can connect things like science to economics, to national security, to popular culture. Because the truth is, it's all connected.
Yeah. It will be easy to politicize this next answer, and I want you not to do that.
Okay.
Is what we're seeing here, and look, let me preface this by saying the Trump administration has fallen down on the job, has only recently understood the gravity of this. Is this a failure of government, or is it a failure of us, I guess?
This is a failure of us because we are the government. The Chinese get to blame Xi Jinping. The Iranians get to blame the mullahs. We don't get to blame anybody but who we see in the mirror, because if we don't like our leadership, we put them there. And as much as we have a historically unqualified captain of the ship of state, that ship has been rusting underneath us for some time. You know, it's not just Trump's fault that we have been dismantling institutions like the CDC. It's not just his fault that we have anti-vaxxers. We are to blame as a democratic society.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. I want to end on a slightly more upbeat note. You tweeted out a video a day or two ago, whenever it was, about staying home and about staying in touch with your dad, but doing it the right way. Your dad, of course, being Mel Brooks. What's the response been to that one?
Unbelievable. The last time I checked, we got something like 12 million views all around the world. It's just sort of exploded, which is a great thing, because all I was trying to do was drive the point home that it's not just about you getting infected. It's who you can infect. You have to think about your loved ones. You have to think about the people who are compromised. So I thought, what better example than me to stand on one side of a window and my dad on the other and say, listen, this is who I could infect.
You ought to see it. It's Max Brooks Author is his Twitter handle. It's a good one. Max Brooks, Zombie Survival Guide, World War Z, a bunch of other stuff. Max, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, Guy. Take care. Be safe.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think Zoom owes me a refund, or maybe a marketplace. I don't know. I think they're paying the fee. Anyway, told you yesterday about that touch up my appearance feature that the video conference service offers and how excited I was to try it on our daily Zoom call this morning. Yeah. Clicked the button, eagerly shifted my eyes up to the screen. Nothing looked exactly the same. Total ripoff. Or maybe the problem's me. There's always that. Face made for radio, you know. All right, we're done. The Dow Industrials up 188 today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ up 160. That is 2.3%. The S&P 500 finished the day 11 points higher, 0.4%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.